Hey, thanks everybody. My name is Nathan Proctor. I am the campaign director for US Perg's Right to Repair campaign. I'm the guy who thinks you should be able to fix your stuff. US Perg is a national organization that stands up to powerful interests whenever public health, democracy, or our rights are threatened. And my colleague?
My name is Gay Gordon Byrne. I'm the executive director of the Repair Association. We're kind of the umbrella group that started the right to repair legislation in states for digital equipment. And we've been at this since 2013, and we're finally getting good at it. Looking forward to being able to tell you what we've been up to.
Yeah, so we're going to go over a little bit about what the right to repair legislation is about, why it's a significant thing to fight for, what are some of the problems that we're trying to address, what are some of the ways in which we're making progress, and how you guys can potentially take part and help.
Some of you may have seen this. It's a pretty popular poster among the iFixit crowd. We are not iFixit. They are one of our members. But we really, really believe in this entire philosophy on this repair manifesto, that if you can't fix it, you don't really own it. And that's the honest truth. If you can't fix it because you can't get a part or a manual or a tool or diagnostic or firmware, there's really something fundamentally wrong, because it is legal for you to fix your stuff. It is your stuff, unless, unfortunately, you agree otherwise. So it's incredibly important that we make sure that we retain the rights we've always had. We've kind of lost them over the past 20 years incrementally, and so slowly we kind of didn't notice, but I think everybody's coming around to the same philosophy, that we really do have to have some legislative action to protect ourselves. So if the OEM blocks you from making a repair, there's something wrong with the contract, there's something wrong with the deal, and you've actually been swindled, because they have no right to tell you what to do with your property once they've sold it to you. And it's the idea that you've been swindled which gives us a legislative hook. For example, it is actually a matter of antitrust that there is no entitlement for a manufacturer to demand that they alone repair your equipment. That would be an illegal tying agreement under antitrust law, going back to 1898. The problem we have is that the US Department of Justice really wasn't set up for the digital world, and not with thousands of manufacturers all doing the same thing at the same time. They are set up to go after bad manufacturers that have 60% market share one at a time. That doesn't work in this world. Apple is a huge manufacturer, but there's 30% market share. How do we go after Apple? Well, the DOJ, we've met with the DOJ, and they were very sympathetic. They understood what the problems were, and they said flatly, you need to go legislative, which was not originally good news. But we did figure it out. What we came up with is using state law to control what people are required to do in order to do business in that state. And the requirements are really simple, and they are the same exact requirements that everybody needs to be able to build a business doing repair. If you can work your way around not having tools, work your way around not having diagnostics, be able to hack and fix the firmware, those are all possibilities, but you can't build a business on it. If you can't know that you can buy parts, get manuals, tools, documentation, diagnostics, and firmware, you can't make a business. So that's the angle that we've taken in the states. Anybody that wants to get in the business repairing anything needs access to all of this, and they need to make sure that it's fair and reasonable as well, so that, like, when my husband spilled coffee on his car, that the chip that got wet wasn't $600. That's what he got charged, because there was no options. That's not fair or reasonable. My microwave oven had a touchpad about this big. Touchpad didn't work anymore. And GE decided that that touchpad was worth $600. Now, the whole microwave wasn't worth $600. So I participated in grotesque abuse of e-waste by throwing away a microwave and buying a brand new one for $179 and going to GE. So this is the problem that we all experience with technology parts, and we didn't experience so much with mechanical parts, because you could go theoretically mill something that would fit. So once you start bringing in a chip and the diagnostics and the embedded software on a chip, that's where the opportunity for monopolization really comes in. So I use this as a five-legged stool because the five-legged stool is very stable. And you lose one of those legs and you're unstable. So right to repair is basically covering all of what you must have to make a repair commercially without having to dodge the law. And we do this in legislation. It's about a one-sentence bill. It says you have to, manufacturer provides, you know, the manuals, the parts, the tools, the firmware, the diagnostics. They can sell the parts and tools. That everything else is free. Whatever it is that they provide to their repair community, their subcontractors or their direct employees, is exactly what they have to make available. So it works pretty well. And it actually has some pretty good history with it. And Nathan, who lived in Massachusetts, the first state that actually did a right to repair bill, can explain how this all went down. But imagine if you're here in New York and New York passes right to repair. We are real close this year, by the way. If you lived in New Jersey or Connecticut, would you be upset by that? No, you would drive to New York and get your stuff fixed and turn around and go home. The same thing would happen in any other adjoining state or any place where you could travel, and parts would travel at the speed of FedEx or overnight service, and information travels at the speed of the internet. So once it's unlocked, it's almost always unlocked for the whole country. And that's why manufacturers are fighting us so terribly hard, because they know that it's one and done. What happened with the auto industry is that Massachusetts passed a bill, but there was 12 or 13 other states with slightly different bills. And you can imagine how difficult that would be for Ford and Mercedes and everybody else to have 50 potential different versions of what they had to provide. So that industry got together and agreed to right to repair. And this is exactly what we're trying to do. And Nathan can talk more about that particular effort.
Right. So in 2012, there was a ballot measure that went before the voters of Massachusetts, which would give most of auto right to repair. It actually doesn't include all five legs of the stool. It didn't include parts, which occasionally is problematic for people in Massachusetts, or people everywhere, I guess. Massachusetts voters passed the ballot measure 86 to 14. That's like a 6-1 margin. That's pretty much unanimous when it comes to these things. And then pretty soon, automakers took that framework that was in Massachusetts and made a national agreement across the auto manufacturers that they would begin to provide the manuals and diagnostics that they weren't providing. And under this agreement, we can mostly still use independent auto mechanics for most of the stuff that goes wrong with our car. Not having parts is a problem, especially for certain highly computerized parts within a car. But I think this showed us two things. One was that there was a framework that you could require companies to give you the stuff that we need to fix our property, and that it would work legally, you know, out in the wild, and that if you passed it in one state, it could become something that would affect every state. And next, I kind of want to talk a little bit about what is the story behind the, you know, what are the values and the worldview that kind of go behind the story. So Gay and I have the wonderful pleasure of going toe-to-toe with the most profitable companies in the history of the world and trying to convince lawmakers that we're reasonable and that they're unreasonable. And I think it helps a lot if you can kind of convey the two different worldviews that kind of come into conflict with this legislation. One would say that you don't really own your stuff. You are a licensed user. You know, when you buy something, it's not yours. You kind of use it under a service end user license agreement with the OEM, the manufacturer. We're going to say OEM instead of manufacturer because it's faster. OEM, original equipment manufacturer. You use it kind of in whatever, you use your property. It's not really yours, you're a licensed user. You use it in whatever way makes the OEM's shareholders happy. They support it. You use it at their, in ways that they want, and they have control. And our version of that story is when you buy something, you own it. You can do whatever you want with it. You could take it apart. You can fix it if you want. I mean, it's yours. It's your property. They have no say in how you use your stuff. We want repairs handled by as many people as possible in this world, right? We want to take the tools of our technology and we want to put them in as most democratic environment as we can possibly manage so that everyone has access to these tools to solve whatever problems they define for themselves. And on the other side, manufacturers want to completely control the tool, protecting it with intellectual property law and huge end user license agreements. And my colleague Gay has coined this term, which I love, called the circular monopoly. They're trying to achieve, you know, we talk about the circular economy, which is this idea that we can create an economy that doesn't just extract and waste, but, you know, creates a circle where we recycle, reuse, repurpose, and take those raw materials back into the product stream. What they're trying to do is essentially create a universal, like a circular monopoly of control over the entire life cycle of a product. And so these are the categories we have, I think, that kind of underlie these arguments we have with these lobbyists when we go in. You know, they try to convince lawmakers that, you know, if people are allowed to use their stuff in whatever way they want, you know, they'll hurt themselves and there'll be all kinds of security problems and, you know, it'll be dangerous and they'll sue these companies. And these companies are really worried about being sued by somebody misusing their toaster. But we've also started to see a number of problems, which I thought we would talk a little bit about. Some of the ways in which companies' treatments of their products as completely proprietary is just interfering with people's daily lives. So one of the first kind of poster children case that really kind of brought Right to Repair to the national attention was farmers. And turns out that John Deere puts software locks on their tractors. So that software needs to like confirm the installation of a new part. If you get the tractor equivalent of a check engine light, it'll essentially deactivate the device and won't let you use it until a certified John Deere technician plugs a computer up to it and punches in a code. There was a fantastic motherboard documentary, which, can we get sound on this? If you look up tractor hacking and motherboard, you can watch this. It's like a 12-minute documentary that they did. I apologize for this. So, do you want to go?
Yeah, go ahead. Finish up with the batteries.
So one problem is, as we saw from that documentary, John Deere farmers using John Deere equipment essentially hired Ukrainian hackers to crack John Deere diagnostic software so that they could actually plant and harvest their crops. And John Deere tried to stop them, and the Librarian of Congress ruled that they had a legal right, to hack their own tractors, which was a nice win for us. But then almost immediately, John Deere changed their end user license agreements to expressly forbid any software modification. If you look up tractor hacking and motherboard, there's a documentary on motherboard, which is a Vice technology channel. It's fabulous. Anyway, and maybe the Ukrainian hacker hired to break those tractors is in this room. Another thing that we see is that, you know, OEMs are in the business of forcing you to buy new stuff. That's how they make their money. They're not really in the repair business. They don't really have the interests of the user at heart. And another problem that comes from this system is they literally cannot fix problems they have with their devices. So one of many Apple device problems, I could probably list about 6 Apple device problems, but this one was kind of notorious. In December, Apple slowed down their phones. They slowed down the phones if it detected the battery on the device was older and was running at a lower capacity. This happened like in December, like right before Christmas, right as they had a poorly performing new phone that came out. It's kind of funny how that happened. And some, you know, some technicians figured out what was going on. They were throttling the processor on the phone. And Apple then admitted that they were doing it and said they were doing it to address, you know, battery drain issues or whatever they said, you know, different performance issues. And so they offered a $29 battery replacement, which is a greatly reduced price if you take your phone to the iPhone to get the battery fixed. And of course, they quickly had like 4 or 5 month long waiting list to swap out batteries of their phones. And we did a little like off the cuff calculation and found that, you know, Apple's like 40 something thousand like Apple Store employees, this is not, they're not even technicians, this is just all their employees. If they did nothing but swap batteries out on iPhone 5s and 6s, and assuming it takes them 15 to 20 minutes to do that, it would take those 40,000 people something like 5 or 6 years of doing nothing but continually swapping batteries to address the, you know, 100 million iPhones that are in use. And they cannot fix the problems that they make with their devices, and they won't let anyone else fix it. And the result is we have this enormous electronic waste problem. Americans throw out 416,000 smartphones every day. One third of the world does not have access to that technology. I mean, that's just an absurd problem to have in the world. We're throwing out usable stuff because the companies that make it won't let somebody else fix it and reuse it for something that's not exactly the purpose that they intended. Yeah. And now we're going to, Gay's going to talk a little bit about what's legal and illegal.
We've been told for a long time that repair is illegal in a lot of subtle ways, and that there, or that it's a blurred line between legal and legal and illegal. And there really is no blur. Repair is fully legal. It is your property. You are allowed to do anything you want with your property. What you can't do legally is copy software and sell it. And that's a very clear definition. So a lot of what we think has gone wrong with it's the problem is basically people are telling lies that become true by repetition. Not true because they're true, just true because we hear it so often we think it must be true. So when we're getting into problems of who owns what and who's responsible for what, for example, if you somehow electrocuted yourself while fixing an iPhone, does that harm Apple? And the answer is absolutely not. The only way that Apple could be harmed is if they'd made a defective product at the outset. And if their product isn't defective and you were just somehow, I don't know how you do it with low voltage, but if you hurt yourself on a phone, it's your problem. Apple says in their contract, it's your problem. They have nothing to do with your problem. It's your medical bills, it's your insurance, but they somehow want to say that they're responsible, but they aren't. So when it comes to liability, they really have to have done something wrong, in which case I think they have a much larger problem than you personally. Think Takata airbags versus cuts from glass on cell phones. So the legal lines are really not nearly as difficult to discern. When it comes to doing legislation, there's really two bodies of law that we have a choice of, and one is to work at the state level or at the federal level, and it lines up very easily. In the state world, general business law, which covers all of your transactions, all of your ownership, you know, licensing, all of those transactions are done at the state level. I shouldn't have said licensing. Take that word back. Anytime you buy something, title, insurance, uniform commercial code, all of those things are part of state law. And if those transactions are unfair and deceptive, states have the right to say you can't work in this state. On the completely other side is federal law. There's no place in federal law that says you have to provide parts. And copyright law is not where that mandate could come. So even though we need to work with copyright law because of the tremendous harm being done by DRM and Section 1201, it's really a totally different process. And I use it as like the 80-20 rule. About 80% of our physical problems with repair are resolved by right to repair in states. The other 20% of problems are really copyright problems, and those have to be dealt with federally. And they both have to happen, but they don't have to happen in any order. So That's why we're working both places. We do a lot of work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've been very involved with all of these DMCA hearings going back to 2012, 15. We're now in the 2018 cycle. It's very important that we're out there and that we have our faces in the Copyright Office, because prior to 2012, we weren't there. The repair industry was not there. And all of these rules were being written that impacted us, and we weren't there. So the entire entertainment software industry was writing copyright law with no pushback. So thank goodness we're finally there. There are two major studies that, if you're interested in copyright law, I think they're really, really well worth reading. They're not, you do have to read the footnotes, and they're kind of long. But these studies were instigated by us, especially over tractors, the two lead senators, Senator Grassley and Leahy, the majority leader and the ranker in the Judiciary Committee, wanted these studies. And they came back studying the impact of embedded software on matters of ordinary equipment repair, such as tractors, refrigerators, and cell phones. And the study came back saying, hey, copyright law is just fine. We've already made provision in the copyright law for repair. It is legal to back up and restore your software for purposes of repair. It is legal to research your software for security holes. It is legal to make modifications to customize that software for your personal use. But you still don't get to sell somebody else's software. Other than that, they said, hey, copyright law is perfectly fine. We were disappointed because we really wanted to make a stronger statement. But they did. They did it in a second study that came out in just about a year ago, in 2017, in June, where they studied the impact of DRM, Digital Rights Management, a.k.a. Section 1201. And what they came back is that, yeah, we agree with you that DRM is blocking legal repair and maintenance for way more products than we ever dreamt. It's not well worded. It should be changed. And we would like Congress, this is their recommendation to Congress, to provide them with enabling legislation that allows for legal repair, takes legal repair and maintenance off of the Copyright Office, with the exception of computer games. So the Copyright Office is still convinced that 14-year-olds are out there copying computer games. This audience knows how true or not true that is. But if that's the price of getting DRM off the backs of repair, I think it would be a good price to pay. And then when we come back to contracts, which is the state side, we've got to remind everybody, the manufacturer owns something, they sell it to you, and then you own it. They no longer own it. They don't have the right to tell you what to do with it. And the contract itself says exactly that. Every contract ever written, and I spent 40 years in commercial contracts, says this. And every contract ever written says, and by the way, we are not responsible for things that you do yourself. We're not responsible for if our equipment is down and your tractor isn't working because it's our fault. We're still not responsible for loss of crops. Your maximum damages are always limited to the cost you paid for the equipment. And the only thing they can't disclaim is a legal term called gross negligence, which means that they really did something wrong. So it is not true that you can hurt the manufacturer, as I said before, by electrocuting yourself. I had a neighbor, it's a very sad story, owned a little nursery, a garden store, and he drove over his adult son, killed him. Was John Deere responsible? Heck no. So these are the kinds of things we seem to have lost our minds about when it comes to technology, thinking that somehow technology is different than other products. But it is not. And the way that the contract should be laid out is that the contract needs to be a complete agreement. You bought it, it's yours. Manufacturer has no say in what happens afterward. But they're sneaking in these little side agreements. They're not supposed to be side agreements. They're supposed to be complete agreements. So every time you have a contract that says there's a reference to an associated license or an embedded license or some kind of end user license agreement, that is not even good contract law. Those licenses are supposed to be totally separate, which gets us back to monopoly. They're not supposed to be requiring you to buy a license to use the equipment. So the legal foundation for right to repair is extremely solid. And the one thing I think you guys could appreciate more than most of the people that I speak with is the role of firmware and who's supporting the firmware. Legislators, we never talk about this stuff because their minds have already been blown. But if you own it and the firmware is part of the hardware, which it really was throughout most of our lives, it transfers. The firmware came with it. It's inseparable from it. And you can do whatever you want to it. I mean, half of the software industry that we know today was based on people tinkering with the software that came with their original computers. We wouldn't have half the products we had if there hadn't been people playing with it. So that's part of their rights as equipment owners, to tinker with the firmware. But if the manufacturer decides the firmware should be licensed, then ownership is completely off the table. If there's one line of code in that firmware that the manufacturer says is mine, it's proprietary, and you can't touch it, and here's the license, then you own nothing. You could spend $1 million for a machine, and if it's controlled by a firmware license, you basically own nothing. And that's the sham of it. That's the farce that we're trying to get people to understand, that you have to have one or the other. You can't have a contract that says, I'm selling you this, and I'm also controlling it. That doesn't exist legally. We either own things or we license them. There is no merged system. So when manufacturers tell us that this equipment is way too technologically sophisticated for us to allow you to repair it, they're really whistling Dixie, because it can't be that way. If they think it's that way, then there's something wrong. And there's unfortunately quite a lot of them that actually believe their own, believe what they're saying. FUD, for anybody that doesn't know what that means, it means fear, uncertainty, and doubt. When we're meeting with legislators, we know in advance, because we've been down this path many times, that the manufacturing community absolutely hates right to repair. But they don't have a leg to stand on legally. They don't have any principles to stand on, so they start making stuff up. The first three flavors are pretty simple. They all say, all right, our copyrights are going to be infringed. And of course not. It's legal to back up and restore software. And so we point out copyright law. Then they say, oh, my patents, and neglecting to mention that patents are public. little problem there. And then they start crying about trade secrets. Well, the interesting part about trade secrets is that if you publish repair documentation and you distribute it to anybody, it's no longer secret. So you can't make that claim and distribute repair documentation to a field engineering force. So that's off the table. Then they start crying about safety. I went over that before. They say it's not our problem. And then they want the problem back only when it suits them to prevent you from repairing your equipment. That's slightly hypocritical. And then this last one has cropped up rather recently. It would be the security farce. We had this showed up about a year and a half ago in Nebraska, where Apple came in and met with the senator who was her bill, and told her flat out that if she passed this bill, Nebraska was going to become a mecca for hackers. And see, we laughed too.
I'm from Nebraska.
Oh, good, good. Excellent. Then you know that nobody in Nebraska, that there's no Bulgarian hackers that are waiting to buy tickets to Omaha just so they can go hack in Nebraska. But this is a problem of education. Legislators do not understand the first thing about cybersecurity. And therefore, they are terrified by even the word cybersecurity. And all Apple has had to do is say, it's insecure. And they believe it. So one of the things I would like to have your help with is, when it comes time to meet with legislators, we could sure use some people that know what they're talking about to come in and sit down and say, hey, I do this for a living. Not that guy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. It's not you. No, I meant philosophically, you know. Lobbyists don't know what they're talking about either. They're beholden to whatever they're told by their employer. So we do need some help with that. And then I put the little sprinkles on top, because there are various other kinds of silly things that they say, such as, we spend a lot of money on training. I'm like, okay, you spend a lot of money on training. Well, so does the other guy. These are all costs of doing business. The dealerships say, oh, we spend a lot of money on our franchise fees. I'm like, okay. That's not my problem as an independent repair shop. I've got my own business costs. So some of these things are pretty simple, silly and easy to debate, but that security one is really quite a problem.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm going to pass it back over to Nathan.
I wanted to tell one story about the security stuff because they clearly honed this argument, and it was that New Hampshire hearing that they really kind of debuted. They had a whole new trade association that was advocating for the security of our things. This is going to be funny for you guys. And they had these lobbyists who knew nothing about technology testifying about. So one of my favorite ones was there was a company who made like these little Internet of Thing cameras that you could put to like monitor your house. And they came to the hearing and they said, you know, if someone repairs this, that's a serious security violation. And I really had wished I had the guts to go up and say, like, hey, just so you know, guys know, when you install these cameras in your house, which you should never, ever do, someone somewhere in the world can look at those images within half an hour. And, I mean, the idea that the guy fixing the battery problem in the webcam is the real security fault and not the fact that these companies are making these unbelievably insecure devices, but that they spend all this time arguing about security when it comes to repair. I don't know. Somebody needs to pop this bubble because it really works. Legislators are really afraid of holding the bag for some kind of hacking of nanny cams or whatever. Let's just talk a little bit about the three fronts right now and the work that we're doing right now to advance rights repair. So the first is that. And the obviously the biggest focus of the work that we're doing together is to pass right to repair legislation in the states. And in 2018, we've had 18 active bills across the country on right to repair, which is up from 5 in 2017. As Gay said, we passed. You said three committees. You passed three committees. We passed. We passed it in three different states. We had a number of bills pulled from the committee by leadership because the committee was about to pass them. And we were very close to getting a full assembly vote in the state of New York this year. And I think that we're definitely getting closer and closer and closer on this. We will have more states that introduce this bill in 2019. New Jersey's still active, so the New Jersey folks in the room, you guys should get connected with repair.org and help us win Right to Repair this year in New Jersey. We're seeing a lot of growth with just increased cooperation and sophistication of our campaign. My job at USPIRG is a federation of state advocacy organizations, and so we're helping to just create strong, effective coalitions in all these states that can really make it difficult for Apple and the other OEMs who want to stop us to fight us in all these places at once. And then the front number two would be that we also, like Gay said, the 80-20 rule, we also need to write copyright law that makes sense. There's two things. One, we need to rewrite the DMCA so that it's not a horrible travesty. And then we can, one of the short-term things we can do is add more devices and more uses to the exemptions of Section 1201. So, for example, farmers can now hack their tractors, and it's not a violation of the DMCA for them to do that because they have a specific exemption from the Librarian of Congress. That's Cory Doctorow and Kyle Weens in April in Los Angeles testifying about some of the telematics and some of the different systems in automobiles, which we're trying to get access to repair, which are currently behind kind of these digital barriers. Right to Repair was also critical in cell phone unlocking. So I think Gay was there for that, so I thought maybe
yep.
2 seconds on that.
When just around the time we were getting our coalition put together, the 2012 version of the DMCA came out and had previously had allowed unlocking and then removed unlocking. And it was enough of an uproar that Kyle Weens and some of the rest of our board members, who became our board members, were able to get 114,000 petition signatures in like a month. It flooded the White House with say, I want to unlock my phone. So by 2014, they got a bill done, which in 18 months in Congress is apparently almost a record in terms of getting a bill passed. I thought it was horrible, and they told me, oh, my man, that's the fastest I've ever seen. So it is possible when you get enough people involved to get bills done. We've had over 70,000 people write their legislators through our widget, which is on our website. So if anybody's so inclined to try to get a bill started in their state, just go on our website, you find the state logo and write a letter. Make a phone call, schedule a meeting, it's that easy. We had a bill in Washington State based on one meeting, one person, one meeting, and that bill almost went all the way through. So individuals make a huge difference in this business.
And then I think the third front that we have to consider this fight against is this throwaway mentality that we've allowed to develop, right? So we want to build an economy and a system where people can fix problems and they have the expectation that they can and should fix their stuff. But first it needs to be possible. So first we need to pass laws that allow people to make it even possible to fix their stuff. And then we need to kind of create repairability, serviceability as criteria for doing business and for buying things for individuals and governments. And then we just need, we need to build in the value of, you know, kind of sustaining our stuff and taking ownership over the things that we have. And companies gain a lot from us just continuing to just think of everything that we have as disposable, and we could always just get another one at Walmart. But as we know, there's a lot of problems associated with that. And so quickly, just before we get into questions, so if how you can help, Gay said, if you want to go to repair.org and take action, send a note to your state legislators or get connected with other people in your state working on this stuff. We are actively looking for people to help us point out how silly these arguments the industry has about security are, and you know, you should definitely contact us if you're willing to kind of help us put together some materials for that. If you contact USPIRG, I can connect you with the actions and things going on in your state. And then also, you could always support organizations like Repair.org and USPIRG. You know, we're scrappy, member-funded organizations going toe-to-toe with, I looked at the numbers from New York, and the total market capitalization of companies lobbying against us was $2.5 trillion. So, I was like, we'll go into questions. We have 5 minutes for questions, and I can't see anybody, so.
Yell.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, okay. I can hear you.
So the car companies have a lot of complex firmware and software in their systems, and it's increasing significantly over time. And computer companies and software manufacturers and telephone companies and so on have put into place over time, we are no longer supporting this system after this date. So I see cars heading in the same direction, and I was wondering how we can get ahead of that, because at some point people will have a car that's a brick because they can't fix it, because the car companies will say, we no longer support this, and presumably we're not making available the underlying firmware, software, information?
Well, the underlying firmware is available, and one of the problems is that certain parts are not available. So that if you have certain electronic components within a car that, you know, are necessary to the operation of the car but are kind of impossible to replicate generically, that's why Gay talked about the five-legged stool. You need all five things to really break the, the monopoly of repair. We have another, like, servicing all the things and all the software in the world is kind of another related problem. But if you could at least reset it to the working order that it came with, that would allow most stuff to keep working.
Yeah, I'd add that access to firmware and the legal authority to hack it which is what, in most of these situations, the U.S., the Copyright Office has granted, will allow for people to support equipment that has been dropped. It may not be as widespread as, say, a Linux operating system, you know, supported by Red Hat, but the opportunity will then be available. Right now, it's prohibited because nobody can get the information. It's all, you know, super secret sauce, which it isn't. So I think Right to Repair will help break that situation down. Legislatively, this is a problem for everything. I mean, we've got to be able to go in and install our own security updates. We've got to be able to go in and have somebody else help us support our older devices, be it firmware or hardware. Otherwise, man, this stuff's going to get thrown away so fast, it's ridiculous.
One more question.
Sure.
Often, products that are repairable and not just disposable are a little more expensive because it takes extra work to, you know, make them. I mean, it's easy for the manufacturers to just, you know, make something and ask you to throw it out. But that is only because really the manufacturers externalized the disposal costs of those. Can you comment at all on how we can de-externalize those costs so that disposable things are not simply cheaper because they're externalized, without simultaneously hurting, low-income communities that can't afford the more expensive premium things?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by externalize.
So it costs money to dispose of electronics.
Right. So the total cost of having there are these horrifying single-use cell phone chargers that you can buy. And it's a battery, you plug into a phone, charge the phone once, and then it's waste. Now, those are pretty cheap, but that's a very expensive product for the public and the world to deal with, because you can just imagine looking at a pallet full of these. I mean, this is all these toxic materials sitting in landfill forever. Those costs live with society. So I think there's a couple ways we can do this. One, this is why I talk about attacking the throwaway culture. Like, we need people to have an expectation of repairability, and we need there to be, like, when things are not repairable, it needs to be a significant issue for the companies that make it. And I think that there's a lot of policies that you could go that would add cost to doing those wasteful things, but then also I think we need to just build that expectation for all the stuff in our lives.
I wish there was more time for questions, but the folks are going to be available outside the conference room to answer any further questions. And Gay, you'd mentioned that you would like the hacker community to help your work. How can they get in touch with you? Is there a slide you can put up or a website you can announce or something?
Well, our main website is repair.org, and all of the emails that say info@repair.org go to me.
Okay. Thank you. Everyone, please get in touch with these people and help them out. They're working for you.
Thank you.